Welcome to the award-winning Disrupt Education Podcast, a podcast that explores the latest innovations and trends in the world of education. I'm your host, Peter Hostrasser, along with Allie Privet.
We're both educators. Okay, one of us is a former educator, and we were tired of the status quo and wanted to create a space where we could have conversations that aren't always in the public eye. Join us as we talk to other disruptors, educators, researchers, and thought leaders who are pushing the boundaries and challenging the way we were taught.
We're thrilled you're here to be part of a not-so-underground movement to disrupt and amplify the good pieces in education. Whether you're a teacher, a parent, or a lifelong learner, there's a story for everyone on Disrupt Education. We're here each week to bring you stories from all over the globe of people doing education differently.
So buckle your seatbelt, get on the disruptor plane as we climb to altitude before letting this episode free fall straight to your ears.
Hey, it's Peter Hostrasser here. And hey, I want to tell you something about how I am actually disrupting education. Yeah, I'm moving forward with portfolios on spikeview.com. If you head over to spikeview.com, basically what we're teaching our students to do is actually to create a skills-based portfolio around their interests, their passions, and what they're good at. It's called the strength-based approach. So basically what we do is we build up our students and have them understand what they're good at and what they're interested in by the time they leave our high school. But it doesn't stop there. It's a K through gray. So if you want your students to continue to build their strengths in this day and age where resumes are dying, and to show more and more about who they are, what they do, and they actually control all the data behind it, guess what? SpikeView is the place for you. Head over to spikeview.com, check it out. Let me know if you need anything, because I tell you what, I have used this with my own family and my students. Check out spikeview.com today. Welcome back to the Disrupt Education Podcast. I'm Peter Hostrasser. I have Allie Privet here, our guest. We'll announce in a moment. Allie, how are you doing?
I'm well. At the time of this recording, we're bringing in summer.
Yes.
And officially, not spring anymore. And it's a time to be outside building and creating and doing things with your hands. I would always tell my students, it would be like, you're ridiculous. But you know, if it was a nice day, I'd be like, go outside and like skip, hop, build, you know, climb trees, do things like out in nature. And you know, just, this is just a good reminder to do that and not lock yourself inside on a beautiful day. So, you know, after we record this,
yeah, inside, everybody go outside.
That's right. Or build, listen some. To this outside.
Stick in a hoop. That's me. I just aged myself. So we have Ken Midget here. He is the plumbing market director at Interplay Learning, but we're going to dive more into the two-time national award winner CTE educator. And I know you're very humble, Ken, but thank you for being here with us today, talking about CTE, the trades, and your experiences.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So if you can give a quick kind of like, you know, who you are and what you do now, and obviously what your connection is to the trades and was and is. You know, when you call yourself a plumbing market director, that's very unique. So I don't know how far you want to go into that either. So give a quick introduction to who you are.
Yeah. Well, I'm a licensed master plumber for 46 plus years. I had two successful plumbing, heating, cooling businesses before the opportunity came to teach in career and technical ed. So that was probably the most enjoyable job that I had. I mean, I like this job too, but I absolutely, and I, people ask me all the time, I miss my students. I miss my interaction with my students. So I applied for a job thinking I would never get it because I had, you know, zero college, and thinking I'm not going to get this job. Turns out that Pennsylvania has a program designed that if you can prove your competency on the skill that you're going to teach, then they will teach you how to teach through college. So I went, I applied for the job, got the job. And when I first took the job, I thought, this is going to be great. I'm just going to sit back and tell these kids stories about all the adventures I had in a business and what it was like to be an apprentice. And well, that lasted for maybe one day a year out of the school year, there would be a default mechanism where we would get into storytelling, and it was short lived because they just weren't interested. Right. Only thing they really showed interest in was the money. I was not afraid to tell my students in my previous career as a business owner that my salary was sufficient, did really well, and had a very enjoyable lifestyle from owning a business. So then get started and, you know, took a little bit of time to get some traction in my program. I taught plumbing and heating, my own discipline. And then I really started to get traction with the cooperative education, placing students on job shadows, internships, and cooperative education opportunities. That was a pivotal moment in my teaching career that changed the dynamics of my classroom management, because I call it the proverbial carrot that hung in front of the ones that were not involved. So a little bit about that. Cooperative education from a CTE perspective means that the student, instead of coming to my classroom, goes to an employer and works and gets paid. And those hours count towards their apprenticeship, their OJT hours, on-job training hours. So that's the unique thing. And I used to tell students, this is the best game in town. You know, you're going to go work with a plumber. You're going to get paid usually double the minimum wage that you're going to earn at McDonald's or Burger King or whatever. You're not going to be doing that type of work in those fast food jobs or working at a Wawa or convenience store. You're going to be engaging and learning your trade right out of the gate at a capacity much more than I can teach you in the classroom from all aspects, right? We're talking about the interaction with the employer, the interaction with me, and just and their learning capabilities. So the program was highly successful, as you said, two awards, and then I got sprung into the catapulted on LinkedIn into the spotlight, and a couple people started to reach out to me over the course of the summer of 2021. Went to work for an insurance company as a home domain expert, and I quickly did okay there, but then it started to get bored, and I really didn't feel like I was contributing back to the industry in that situation. In one small spot it was because I was training plumbers who were not capable of working in the industry for physical reasons, so they were able to use their talents a different way. So that was one little part of it, but I really had missed the classroom, and I had missed my interaction with my post-secondary students that I taught, the apprentices. So I had always been a subject matter expert for LinkedIn, or for Interplay Learning, I'm sorry. And the job came up for this plumbing market director, and I spoke to the CEO, who knew me already. And one thing led to another, and almost... tomorrow will be 11 months here.
All right.
From when I was hired last July. Great job. And what I do is I organize the curriculum to match what the market wants and what the apprenticeship models need. And you know, they brought me into a program that wasn't completely complemented there. So I'm working very hard and diligently with the production team to get the courses put into position that model all those needs. That's kind of my job. And it's a tech job, and it's, you know, I love technology, which when I talk about my teaching career more, you'll see why.
About the infrastructure in the program that you mentioned, where students were going to basically in paid internships and work experiences, is that did you help build that infrastructure or enhance it? And, you know, like, because we talk a lot about this disrupt education of these types of coordinating experiences and having that infrastructure in place to allow students to even have those opportunities. So is that, again, something you walked into or did you build it from the ground up? Tell us a little bit more about that.
I won't take any credit for creating it, because it was there long before I started to even work there. But what I will say as an entrepreneur and a capitalist is I completely capitalized that entire system to make it benefit for my students and for the program in general. So what does that look like? So to take the path of a student comes into the program as almost any grade, but let's take that ninth grader as an example, because that's a really good case study. And they learn some basic skills. They learn a lot about safety, and they also learn some of the soft skills side, like, you know, how should I interact with an employer? How do I act in an interview? What should I do? What do I look for in a model company for me to work for? What should I say and not say to an employer? What should I not say and say to coworkers? Right? We go into the whole dive about sexual harassment and behavioral and comments and using your phones and not using your phones. It's a very deep dive in addition to all the technical stuff that they're acquiring at the same time, right? So how do we learn that? We learn that through some content delivery, typical lecture. A lot of it, my program was heavily involved with technology, big, big user of technology. If you walked into my classroom, you could immediately tell there was a huge Promethean board that was interactive on the wall, and we used it every day. I mean, it was just constantly running. And that path of that ninth grader, they would get enough under their belt. And if the rest of the ducks would line up, meaning did they get their driver's license? Is mom, dad, or guardian okay with it? They would go on to a job shadow. So that's a 1 day long 8 hour interview, right? If I'm working for Peter and I'm the student, I'm interviewing Peter's business and Peter's interviewing me, a working interview, if you will. There's limitations to what they're allowed to do in that job shadow. Forward into my career teaching there, this became a competition for that ninth, 10th, or 11th grader, because there would be several students circulated through that employer. And that employer would say, I really liked Allie. She was fantastic. That's the one I want. She showed well, she interacted well with my existing employees, and that's the one I want to bring on. Well, then I would work with Allie, her parents, her guardian, and make sure the driver's license. And instead of coming to my class, you would go to work every day. You would come in twice a month to see me and the workforce coordinator that would do that, called the co-op coordinator. It's actually a certificated thing to be able to do that. And they're dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's. Does the employer have the clearances? What's the interaction like? Making sure that Allie doesn't just get stuck in a corner pushing a broom, that you're really learning plumbing every day, right? You're not the coffee person or whatever. You're making sure that the curriculum is being followed and it's matched up with what I have going on in-house. I also was very proactive in my communications. My students texted me all the time. We had communications by email because we were using Google Classroom. So there was a lot of interaction that way, even with that student that was out working. So that's pretty much how it would work. Now, where the carrot started is when you would come back to class after working 4 or 5 months and you had new outfits on, and maybe you had a new watch or you had a new phone, and hey, how'd you get one classmate to another? How did you get that? Oh, well, I'm making bank now. I'm working for ABC Plumbing Company. And this is what you need to do to get your ducks in a row so you can go out there, right? And this, when they would see that 2 days a month when those co-op kids would come in, the rest of the class, there was a whole different culture in that day, because those students that were not in those positions were looking at the ones who were and thinking, I got to get there. I got to do what I need to do. So you can see this, how I'm creating this path, if you will, for them to get to that point. So, put some numbers in perspective, 100% placement for any eligible senior who graduated. I would run at least no less than 150 to 200 job shadows a year for all different students, even ones that I knew maybe couldn't do the outdoor or couldn't do it because they weren't going to get their driver's license, or there was a financial implication that would keep them from getting a car. I still put those students involved because I wanted them to have that real world experience. Nothing, you can't replicate that in a classroom. You can get close, but you can't replicate it. So those things literally drove the entire classroom as far as why it was so successful and why it became a point where I would take more students than I was capped at for my classroom, because I would know in my PM class, there'd be at least 10, 12 kids out on co-op. So I would just take more of kids that maybe weren't eligible for co-op yet and bring them in that afternoon session. We had two sessions there, by the way, to make sense of that. There was an AM session and a PM session. The school was Lehigh Career and Technical Institute. They're in Schnecksville, Pennsylvania. Third largest in the country, big school. There's 9 different schools from Lehigh County that come to that school. So when Peter and I first chatted, it is quite the menagerie and logistical nightmare of watching these kids coming and going, all these buses from different school districts, leaving, coming. Some eat lunch at our school, some eat lunch back at their home school. So there's a lot of managerial things that a teacher has to deal with in this environment, because you have a staggered start time. You know, one student gets there at 8 o'clock, one gets at 8:40, because that's the way their bus schedule works. And the same thing on their departures. A lot of them leave at all different times, right? So you're managing this. You could have 25 kids, you could have 4, depending on how that's happening. And then if there's an event happening at their home school, then they may not even be in that day, right? So now you have online learning that has to take place because they're missing the day. So it really becomes a thing that you grow into. You become consumed by this environment. I've always loved kids. I'm a big kid myself. I can act silly as they do. Very charismatic teacher. I would think nothing of getting up and walking across the desks as I was lecturing. And if somebody was asleep, their books got kicked on the floor. That's just the way it was, right? And if I was lecturing and there would be some kind of disruption, I would just sit down next to those students and I would stop lecturing and say, you must be talking about something extremely important, because I feel what I have to say is important. So you have the floor. Stand up and tell us whatever it is. And it would just extinguish. The problem would go away. And sometimes they would talk. That was the funny part. Sometimes they would say, well, you know, ironically, you stopped me, coach. And by the way, all my students, everybody, administrators, parents, students, alumni, apprentices, even some of my colleagues that were in the plumbing profession call me coach. Mm-hmm. It's just something that stuck from the very beginning of my career. They would say, it's funny you say that, because I do have something to talk. I was on a job yesterday, or I watched this video, or we had a plumber at our house. And I would say, okay, you got the floor. This is a real world moment. Mm-hmm. Go at it. Tell us all, right? Tell us what happened. And you would find out that the kid was like right next, there's the plumber under the kitchen sink, and here's my student's head right there with that plumber trying to see what they're doing, right? That's what you would find out.
As Allie and I were just talking before this, and we were conversating about like structures of school days and how those things hinder. I really like the fact that there is the capitalistic look at this. There's competition, there's money involved. The students, every student that I talk about, that talk to me about like, why don't you like school? Well, you know, we don't really get paid to be here. Well, now, you know, there are models like you're talking about that they can. And I honestly think this is scalable beyond the trades. I really do. I think the trades have always led into this. But with that being said, everybody wants like an outcome or an assessment, right? Outside of, I mean, maybe they are getting certified, there's certifications and such. Can you talk to the degree of what were the quote unquote assessments or outcomes? Not the journey is so important, and we know that, right? I think though that in traditional education, it's like an outcome. What did you get on the SAT? What were your GPA? You know, I think Allie and I have already kind of thrown that out somewhat. I think it does have some value, but What were those outcomes looking like for those students? Obviously, 100% placement, there's an outcome. But what was there anything else that you can speak of to those?
Every year, students must take a completion exam. That's the equivalent of a SAT to a CTE learner or year-end program testing, right? The difference is that this person has to have X amount of hours in the program to be eligible to take that test. Mm-hmm. So there was 1400 hours calculated over a 4-year period for a student. And Pennsylvania's law is if a student is going to reach 50% of that by their graduation time, then they must take the test. There's not an option. And it was a big deal in my classroom. Really big deal. We always scored at the, not always, but shortly after I really got traction. First two or three years were rough. By year four, everybody's hitting at the advanced level, every single senior that took that test. So the funny thing about this is that the proctors, it's a proctored test, it's a split test. There's a written test, 190 some questions, multiple choice. And then there's a psychomotor test where the student has to put plumbing in a wall, right? And that's measured by proctors. And these are people that could hire them, right? Potentially. So those, the ones that weren't hired, if they showed well in this test, they were getting business cards from the proctors at the end of the test, right? Just a wonderful thing to see happen.
Yeah.
So I did really well. I had some of the highest scores in the state, and I was in the top 3% in the country with the scores from completion exams from that program. So the kids absolutely knew the content. Lots of times people would say, Midget, you're just teaching the test. And I said, so what? And who cares? Are they learning? I said, are your students out working in the real world? What, you know, tell me what you're doing, right? So I wouldn't care. And that's a bad, to me, I could take the hit if somebody said that from an academic perspective, that I'm just teaching the test, memorizing questions, blah, blah, blah. They knew the content. You could pull them aside and expand in a critical, creative thinking environment and say, tell me more about the answer to this question. How did you derive at it? And they could answer you that question, right? And there was a process to make them all successful. Whether you were taken NOCTI or not, that's what the name of the completion exam is. You were involved in some way in this program to contribute toward that. If you were an underclassman, you were helping set up the walls for them to practice that, because I made my own walls with my own measurements. And if you were a underclassman, you were listening to the lecture that one of the seniors were giving with a mock question every day as the question of the day. So that's how they learned the deeper learning of what the question really meant, right? So that's how everybody participated. If the seniors all got advanced, I had a feast called the NOCTI feast that I made all my own stuff. They had a day of just eating, literally. The girls didn't eat so much, but the boys could just chow down the food like there was no tomorrow. And it was such an enjoyable thing. I had administrators from all over the state would come in when I would have this NOCTI feast, and they're watching my interaction with these kids and they're seeing what's happening. And, you know, people would say, well, how do you incentivize these kids to take this test? A lot of kids, some students call it the Nazi test. They don't even want to touch it, right? That's how bad they feel about it. And this is what helped create that environment. This, the co-op, the feast, they just loved it.
Something you mentioned right before we hit record, but I think it needs to be addressed, is you said that the skills and trades are really disruptive of the traditional educational model. And so I'm curious with your background, in what sounds like this whole system that you were in. I love that it was a big system and that students, you know, had these opportunities, because it shows other school districts that are, have huge schools. It is possible, it's scalable, it's being done. But I really want to know more of your thoughts on, you know, why do you feel like the skills and the trades are so disruptive to education? And, you know, I do like your point, and I don't want people to miss it, that who cares if you teach to the test, because there are points in your life that society, for whatever reason, wants you to check a box. Like, even if you're a lawyer, like you have to take the, you know, the LSAT, and then you have to take the bar exam. And like, it is something that for the most part, you're not using most of that information, but you do have to train yourself for and take. But that's not necessarily how you practice or what you end up doing, but it's some kind of like a stamp of approval that is part of the system. So I want to know, like, why you think it's disruptive. And then, you know, besides the test, what other kind of skills and learning do people get in this type of environment that they don't get in a traditional model?
I'll start by saying that It's getting better, but I mean, I went to a career and technical school when I was in high school, and you can see by the gray hair, that was a long time ago, but they were always saying that that's where all the dumb kids go, the druggies, the bad kids. That's what CTE is for. That's what that tech school is for, is to give these students an eligible chance to pass high school, to get out of high school. That's what they used to say. And there is some of that stigma still attached, but it's getting much, much better, right? It wasn't uncommon for most of the career and technical ed classes that my colleagues taught, my own class, to have a 45 to 50% ratio of students with IEPs. And one of the things I loved the most was proving everybody wrong, that a student that has an IEP isn't going to make it. I have students out there right now that are making 150 grand as a plumber that had IEPs when I were in my classroom. So I could prove you wrong. It's a matter of how you deliver the content. And what's different in the disruption method is much of career and technical ed, you have the employability side that you're going to measure from a grades perspective. Then you have a section of academics, and a lot of the academics is the lecturing side and the foundational knowledge. And then you have the manipulative skill, right? Can you or can you not assemble these two pieces of pipe to industry standards? Can you solder a piece of pipe? Can you flare a piece of copper? Can you press this joint? Can you install a bathtub? Can you repair a toilet? Two industry standards. What does that mean? That means that I am watching you while you are doing that, and it is physically and mentally impossible to cheat. So you have a performance objective to accomplish as you go through this task, whatever it may be, and I'm standing there watching you, right? So it's not like taking a paper test or a computerized test that you can make some kind of effort to put more effort into cheating on the test than actually what it would take to study to take the test. There's no game there. You can't win, right, with this environment. That's one of the things I like about it the best. You either can or you can't prove your stuff. And I also would hear from higher level learning, well, you're not really teaching critical and creative thinking. And I used to go after those people and say, really? Here's a project. It leaks. Tell me why it's leaking. Tell me why it's wrong and what you're going to do to fix it. And I'm not telling you any more information. Goodbye. Let me know how you make out. And I would walk away. So I would literally I was coined by this statement when a student would say to me, I just don't know what I'm doing with this. And I can't seem to get anywhere. And they would say, what do you think I should do about this? And I would say to them, that is a great question. I'm glad you're thinking about it. What I want you to do is let me know how you make out finding the answer. And I would walk away. I would force them to think. Now, there was a balance with this, right? You have to know your kids and, you know, not be saying that 24/7 because you're going to just, well, this guy doesn't really want to help me, right? There was times where I would pull them aside and say, still want to give them the answer. I would just give them more questions to get to the answer. So I feel that I created that critical and creative thinking. We had group learning. We had project-based learning involved. I mean, just imagine that, you know, we're going to remodel a bathroom, the three of us. And Allie, you're going to be responsible for the demolition and all the permits. And Peter, you're going to be responsible for ordering the new material. And I'm going to be responsible for making sure the dumpster's there, right? Whatever that is. We all have responsibilities, and now we all learn from each other how to obtain those responsibilities. So I'm teaching people to work in the group environment and solve problems, which is what the world wants. I would tell students when they were in my program, I don't care if you're going to take plumbing. I would love that you do it. All I care is that you're successful. That's what I care about. And I have students that are all over the place that are doing things that are not doing plumbing that are highly successful. Truck drivers, people that worked for the plumbing in a year, realized that this isn't what I want to do, pivoted. Now they're in college and they're going to be a biochemist. Whatever you want to do is okay with me. Just be successful and be the best you can at it. Those were my rules with them. And I think I just said it so many times, it just became ingrained in them that this is the way you're supposed to do things.
So I used to apprentice or actually have a part-time job with electricians in college, right? Absolutely loved it. When you said critical thinking, I mean, there's an academic way of looking at that, and then there's a reality way of looking at that. And I think that's where we all kind of cross paths here. We're trying to like, okay, yes, you can teach critical thinking by the steps of an algebra problem, or you can teach critical thinking by the steps of, you know, bending this conduit around this really awkward turn, because you got to run a wire through here, and how are you going to do it safely and to code. And I remember doing that. I mean, it's an art form. There's so many skills that go into this. I just started thinking about those things as you were talking about a student, actually, how are you going to fix this? How are you going to do this? And then also, you know, I remember, and I know that Allie and I've had this conversation. I was, running wire underneath, a crawl space on a home. And this was in Culver, Indiana, way back in the day. And, you know, the electricians that I was working for, they would come down, like literally crawl under and take a look. And he was like, okay, this is good. Can you make this turn a little bit better? And I remember as, I don't know, a 20-year-old, I was like, but, you know, no one's really going to see it. And he's like, I'm going to know it's here. And what you're doing is you're taking pride in your work and how you can do that. So, you know, what I really like about the conversation that you're talking about here, where you have to perform and then you have to actually show, is, you know, the grade is where a lot of kids, yeah, but I got an A in class. And I can't tell you, Ken, how many times I've asked a student, well, what did you learn in the class? And there's this long pause of, you know, I've had conversations with, you know, other business teachers are like, yeah, I have an accounting student who got an A and I wouldn't let him touch my money, you know, like, so I love this performance piece. I think that we need more of it in generalized education earlier on. Another challenge that I have personally in classrooms are, we do have a pretty strong kind of trades way to get kids into it. We have a building and constructions and math. There is a welding course. I don't think we go to the point of the tech school. And I think that's, I don't like that. I want more, you know, I want students to have more. We do get a lot of students who are just like, yeah, I'm going to be an electrician after high school. So I'm literally not going to do anything right now. When, you know, they're in a business class or a career planning class where they can build portfolios, and they're so just like, they think that they can just walk into something like that. So, you know, with that being said, you've seen these programs, an amazing program in Pennsylvania and such. What would you do if you had a school that is kind of there? Because I think schools are kind of getting there. But what do you think is the biggest outcome that a school needs to have for a student, whether they're sending kids to a tech school or not, that want to go into the trades? What do you think of like step one and maybe step two that needs to happen pretty quickly?
I think that the largest impact, to answer your question, that could change the dynamics of how a school operates is much more engagement with the stakeholders. So if I'm a plumber, I'm an electrician, I'm a plumbing contractor, I'm an electrical contractor, I'm a business owner, and I teach, and I have, that's what I have is I'm accounting. They should be interacting with the schools, and they should be saying, look, I don't want to hire somebody from California. I want to hire somebody right from here. How do we do that? How can I help? So it's a two-way environment. A lot of times industry tries to come into education, and then there's this rub, if you will, and that, well, you can't do this. They're getting told all the time, you can't do this, you can't do that. No, you can't do that with a student. No, you can't do this. You can't do that in the classroom. So the industry just says, you know what? I guess we're just going to wait till they hit 12th grade and hope for the best, right? Whereas if there was a engagement between the stakeholders and administration and superintendents, I would think you would see a process start to happen where you would go in the direction, potentially building a school, a building just for it, right? And housing it with teachers and students and creating these paths for the alternative way of getting out of high school and getting a super high-end successful jump start instead of just graduating with a general education and then going applying or to learn a skilled trade. Not that there's anything wrong with that. By far, my students had the upper leg all the time over somebody just walking in off the street and applying for a job, right? There was a reputation with the program that came with that student, and the student knew what the expectations were of an employer. So right off the bat, they have a different, and they knew about the industry. They knew about all the different avenues they could pursue. And they would, you know, they knew what it meant to put on a nail plate or be safe on a ladder, or how material should be loaded into a truck, or how you lift up a toilet when it's heavy, or whatever the things are. They would come in with that knowledge, right? So that was the change up. But to answer your question, my first thing is that it has to be the connection between stakeholders in that school district and the administration and superintendents. And then from there, I think administration and superintendents need to look for alternative ways, grant money, apprenticeship grant money, Perkins money, and think about utilizing that money in different ways to help accelerate these this program that could become a prototype. And maybe they start small. You know, maybe there's somebody who teaches, maybe there's still an industrial arts that teaches a wood shop. Maybe that person starts working with a cabinetry company that makes cabinetry in the area. In Pennsylvania, we had makes the guitars. I can't think of the name of the company. It's a very famous company for guitars. They were in our area. The cabinetry shop used to go tour it every year with the students. Mm-hmm. So they could see, well, yeah, I signed up for cabinetry, but wouldn't it be cool if I made guitars? Right. So the kids would get exposed to this information.
As you're talking, I'm sitting here thinking, like, you know, what's a great buy-in for schools? And it's this idea that even if students don't want to go into the trades specifically, that's not the career path that they see themselves going in. I can say with good certainty that people will likely become owners of places to live, and knowing how to fix, build, curate, I mean,
repair,
not fall off of a ladder, are skills that are applicable no matter what field you go into. And if I'm sitting here as a school district stakeholder, board member, you know, admin, whatever level you're at, even, you know, going all the way up to the federal level, having people who can solve home problems or have some idea of how to fix things in their homes sounds like a pretty good life skill to have. I mean, I think about my family has restored and renovated an early 1900 old building, and all of this creative problem solving that you were talking about when people say, like, oh, you know, where is that critical thinking in the skills? And I think about my dad, one piece of board, because of the unlevel nature of 100-plus-year-old building and everything, he had to do a carpentry project that required each level of the board to have, like, different cuts. And it took him all afternoon to measure, figure it out. And I was like, it's just one piece of board in between two spaces, a bathroom and a thing. And yeah, he's like, yeah, I did. He was so proud of this board and had spent all this time measuring it and cutting it. And then he goes, yeah, so people can step on it.
I've been involved in licensure environments where, you know, a city or borough wants to get rid of the plumbing licenses and, you know, dumb it down and make the test be easy for them to get the license and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of pushback from the industry, and rightfully so. And I'm proud to say I was one of those people pushing back. And I had a board member from a city say to me, Ken, just how hard is that plumbing test anyhow? You guys are going on and on about it. You know, when I took my master's a long, long time ago, it was a 3.5-hour test. Your brain was shot. I took a lot of studying, and I would say, okay, well, if you don't think it's important, then we'll just stop doing it. And when all the things come back that plumbers created, you know, separating quality water and having comforts inside your home and not going into an outhouse, well, how hard is it? I said, okay, I'll tell you what, pretend that wall over there is a commercial bathroom and you need to lay out all the urinals and toilets along that wall. See you later. Goodbye. Let me know how you make out. Tell me what, and when you're all done, tell me what we're all, everything's going to go. Give me the material list. Tell me why it's that size pipe. All these information, all these things I need to know. Tell me why. And when you can, in 20 seconds, like you're alluding it to be, I'll have your back and say it's not important to take the test. So, that's, and I think sometimes that just trickles into society. There's just, you know, that's why we're in the situation we're in, where you hear about the skilled trades gap. It's just the dumb and bad kids go to the vocational school. This is why we're in those scenarios where there's a gap, right? This is a huge gap and great opportunities for people in high school, people entering high school, probably for the next 5 to 10 years till the problem gets resolved, corrects itself.
I go back to the critical thinking. I just keep going back to that. And I'm that guy who will like hang out with any tradesperson in my house. I usually do the electrical work in my house because that's what I know. I don't touch the box. I think we talked about that beforehand. You know, I'm not going in there, but like recepts and things like that, I can do. When it comes to plumbing, yeah, I mean, I'm sure I could probably learn how to do it, but I just don't trust myself with water in my own house. And we had a, to your point of critical thinking, we had a water heater that was malfunctioning. We have a ginormous water heater. I think they just put a huge, you know, 6 million gallon one in there, but that's okay. I got two teens right now. So, but it was just on the early part of when they, you know, you read the reviews, 6 years it needed replaced. And so the person that I hired was a friend of mine, and he came in and, you know, he was looking at it. And to your point, like, you have to stop and think, okay, this is a good water heater. It's on the early part of it. Why? Right? Why is this thing not working? So, you know, he went through everything. And the one thing that he found that I know 60% of non-registrated plumbers, maybe 100%, wouldn't have thought of, is they walked through the vent, and the vent had been pushed to a point where it was concave, I guess, where moisture was coming back down into it and rusting out the bottom of it, right? And he went out and redid that. And he's like, that was something that I found. And I would have never thought, I mean, I have generalized, you know, information. And that's to the point, right? Like of understanding how to really, you know, go through this rigorous thought process and walk through where water is going or coming, or, you know, what is happening. And I like Ali said, it's the same thing. Like, you know, you have somebody with a lawsuit, what kind of law? It's the same thing. It's just that we have the stigma on top of it. And I really love the fact that you can't cheat with this. I really like that, because it's so funny when you say that this is disrupting education, that you can't cheat. I mean, isn't that weird though? But that is it, right? Like, you can cheat on everything. I mean, well, you know,
there's actually another way I thought of that we're disrupting education in CTE.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's different modalities. Some people learn with their eyes, some people learn with their ears, some people learn by doing, right? Mm-hmm. Touching, kinesthetic learner. I want somebody to tell me how you teach the academic setting with a learner that their strength is in kinesthetic. How do you teach them? How do you get the point across? Because they're not learning by watching or listening or hearing. They have to touch something to learn it, right? So to that point, one of the benefits of CTE is that there were lots of times, once the safety part was out of the way, a student would say, hey, can I just go try lighting a torch? Or can I just go, you know, I watched Joe do it or Sally do it. Can I just go try it? And I would say, if you're signed off on the safety, go. You can't hurt anybody or yourself. Go ahead, have at it. And it was reversed education, in that the student would go learn how to solder with their hands and then go back and do the written academic portion, and the deal is sealed, right? And I won. And so did the student, most importantly, won. They learned, right? So those opportunities aren't given in the academic environment, other than maybe phys ed or some of the other types of courses where you're going to learn doing something with your hands. Mm-hmm. How else can you teach that student? How can you reach them? And these are the ones I think that struggle, that become a discipline problem in the academic setting, and they're tagged as a bad student when they're really not bad. They just don't learn that way. Or they get tagged with a learning disability because they're a kinesthetic learner. That's nonsense.
Yeah.
So this is another way CTE disrupts education, is that we can fix that, the kinesthetic learner guy and girl.
The downplaying of trades and that the stigma that it has, that, oh, we're going to put quote unquote dumb or the people who can't learn in this. I mean, so off base for so many reasons, because taking something that you can either see or have read and then physically do it with your hands is such a skill that like it shouldn't be disruptive. There's so many people that can't do that. Right. And it should be something that's in education more, because the gap is there because education is spending all this time, you know, cultivating our brains, but then like not connecting it kinesthetically to our hands. And think of all the learners that is not a natural modality that would benefit from a system that helps them learn how to watch a YouTube video and then recreate it. that's a real skill of something, or, you know, that's not something that is easy for me. But I always benefit from working on those skills. So right to your point, Ken, is that right for the kinesthetic learner, it's awesome because it's the right reverse cycle. But what about the people where that isn't natural? We're just avoiding it. Even more reason to have those types of learning experiences and shop classes and technical skills and building things with your hands. It seems so counterintuitive to not be doing it more.
I want to touch back on the point that you made that, you know, let's take this student journey where they go through you know, 2 years in current technical ed, and then they graduate and they say, you know what, I'm going to go to college. I'm going to be whatever it's going to be. I'm going to be a doctor. Think of what you learned there and then take that another step. Like I use the terms mechanically intuitive. So somebody who's like, you take that person, well, I don't even know which end of a screwdriver to hold, right? That person, right? Think of that person now even knows what a screwdriver is. There's five different kinds. There's different lengths. The safety factors of using one, to your point, climbing up and down a ladder. Think of all those other things that person, your quote, life skills, right? Mm-hmm. That could aid in so many other things, to like what you were talking about your dad with the board. Like somewhere along the line, he learned to be mechanically intuitive to be able to get that board to fit so it was flat. And yeah, okay, all they were going to do was walk on it, but he knew what went into that board, right? I think that's the difference. Mm-hmm. That traditional academic education doesn't get that done.
Yeah. You know, to that point and rounding it off, like a doctor and let's just go with, you know, a builder, right? As my brother-in-law is a ear, nose, throat surgeon. And one of the things that he had to do is actually, you know, hands-on suture. Like he had to have the dexterity to do that. Well, guess what? So does a builder, right? Mm-hmm. And these things. And so there's a lot more connections. That's some, you know, my end thought here is there's a lot more connections in real life that CTE is bringing out and the trades are bringing out that we actually give it credit for. And I think that's where the mindset needs to change. It is slowly changing. I think that there, you know, whenever there's like this big shortage, people start to pay attention. Unfortunately, it's usually too late when it's governmental, but you know, I'll get on the wave and let's get going. And I think, you know, Ken, you really have brought a lot of these great examples and continue to bring these great examples of connecting academia and reality, right? And I think that it's not an either or, it's a yes and. And we say that a lot here, but, you know, I will never, ever trade in those experiences working with electricians. It was an amazing, you know, piece. It stays that way forever. Like, you're going to run wires, you know. Yeah, I may have to learn a little bit about solar or other ways of energy in that capacity. I have never ever forgot those, and I'm old. That was like 30 years ago, right? So so to your point, it's unforgettable. So appreciate that. Allie, wanted to ask you final thoughts as well, and then Ken, we'll get your information and some final thoughts as well.
Ken is one painting a vision of the importance of this through many different facets of this conversation. There are routes to kind of redirect this image that is put upon the trades, and have stakeholders and decision makers value them more than ever before for kind of that lifetime. I think it's like lifetime learning value that you're speaking to. And then I have a feeling, because I can just sense like the wealth of knowledge that you have and in this arena, that this will not be our last conversation together.
Any final thoughts, Ken, as well? Like, you want listeners out there, we have a lot of educators, a lot of parents, a lot of administrators, and a lot of students listening. So what's your final thoughts?
I actually have two things, if I may.
Sure.
One, one of the things I didn't speak about that was really very predominant in my program is I coached and recruited the non-traditional worker. So I had a lot of girls in my program, and I had a lot of people of all different races and creeds and religions, and they all learned and became successful, right? There's one of the girls has her master's now, right? She was on national television in a show. It just was all kinds of things happened for her. And there's going to be some more that happened too. I can't speak about too much, but in October, there'll be some more happening, not on national TV, but pretty big on YouTube. Nice. And the second thing is that I think academic teachers need to sometimes think about this kinesthetic learner and how can they teach them better. And I'm going to give you an example. When I taught reading a ruler, students would line up on a line, and the ones that were out the furthest, they were the inch. The ones that were back were half inch. The ones that were further back was a quarter. And this was everybody involved. Everybody had to pay attention. And I would say, okay, show me 4 3/8. And they would have to separate where 4 3/8 inches were. And they learned what they understood it. And now they understand how 2/8 equals 1/4 without even doing the math, right? Going, teaching it beyond that. And then teaching geometry, all the shapes, the Pythagorean theorem, we taught that in a parking lot. We made a triangle and said, tell me how many steps it's going to take to go across here. Who could tell me the best guess? It's 8 foot that way, 7 foot this way. How many steps is Peter going to be by the time he gets across? That's how you teach it. That's the kinesthetic learner, mm-hmm. right? And they understood, they could go into their math class and do the Pythagorean theorem on a piece of paper and pencil, mm-hmm. but they learned it out in a parking lot. Yeah. So I would encourage teachers who do administration. I know it's such a tough profession with all the things that you get thrown at you as an educator. But if you could take that one little slice of time and try to think of something creative that you can be, take those kids to another level, take them to another level, and try to find ways to incorporate that into your pedagogy to get them to the point where they can learn, that kinesthetic learner can learn something without you struggling as an educator.
That's spot on. Ken, where can people connect with you and learn more, not only like just with Interplay, but more of your expertise around CTE and such?
I'm pretty well known on LinkedIn. I would say that would be the best go-to. If you search my name, Ken Midget, it's going to come up. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can go to interplaylearning.com and reach out to me that way. Happy to help whoever I can help try to turn the gear, because it's a big gear to turn.
Right? Yes, absolutely. Excellent. Thank you so much again for sharing your expertise. I'm going to end on the one thought that I had when one of my previous students, who is actually a blacksmith, he taught himself calculus by, awesome, you know, blacksmithing. And I was like, that blew my mind. And that was many years ago. And that's what really started to open my eyes to this and the different things that we can do. So you've given us a lot of thought processes and different ways that we can look at academics and reality and the trades. Appreciate your time here today, Ken.
Awesome. Thank you, Allie and Peter. Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun. I love to talk about this. You can feel my passion, I'm sure.
100%. And I think I'm going to agree with Allie. I don't think this is going to be the last time we have you on. So for Allie Privet, I'm Peter Hostrasser. Thank you all for hanging out with us on the Disrupt Education podcast. Check out our links in the notes and connect, and we'll help you out and keep moving and disrupting education. Thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of the Disrupt Education Podcast. Be sure to like and subscribe so you never miss an episode.
Are you ready to disrupt the educational arena you're a part of? For more ways to get involved in the work we do here at Disrupt Education, check us out at disrupteducation.co or find us on LinkedIn at Peter Hostrasser or Allie Privet.
Our mission here is to help facilitate and amplify changes in the educational system through local initiatives and help you scale them into community movements. Our building network of disruptors in education are working to move beyond scores and grades as the only measure for student learning. If your school district, college campus, or organization is looking for facilitators of this work, reach out on our website or social media.
And if you have any thoughts or feedback on this week's episode or any episode, we'd love to hear from you. Until next time, keep pushing the boundaries, taking risks, and most importantly, disrupting education.